Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with a very special guest, one that I have known of for many years and now have the pleasure to speak with, Dr. Barbara Marino. She is trained as an OBGYN physician, but has had additional fellowships in gynecology, oncology, as well as worked in the cosmetic and other realms of the OBGYN and other aspects of medicine. Without delving too much further, I'd like to go ahead and introduce Dr. Marino so that she can talk about her background. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Marino.
Hi. It's nice to talk to all of you.
Dr. Marino, before we get into some of the legal aspects of our conversation, I want the audience to understand just how extensive and broad your training has been, and indeed your clinical practice has been as a physician for many years. Can you talk a little bit about your original residency training, your fellowship training, and where you went on to subsequent in your career?
Sure. My original residency training was in a Catholic hospital in Columbus, Ohio, which is an affiliate of The Ohio State University. And we did, we were required to do a broad range of rotations during our first year, our internship year. So I had experience with general surgery, urology, and pathology. That was the third one that I did in addition to doing OB-GYN. So once I completed my residency, I was the 13th woman to be accepted in the GYN oncology fellowship program at MD Anderson Cancer Center. So they had a new program where you could opt to do 2 years of basic science research, which I very much wanted to do. I worked with worked in two unique aspects of basic science. One was with EGF receptors, believing that they were going to be important ultimately in vulvar and cervical cancer. And then I also worked in a lab that did oncogenes, most importantly, the HER2-NU oncogene, which we looked to, and P53. We looked to see if they were involved in ovarian cancer. So then I did the 2 years clinical training and had a published paper out of that looking at the spread of ovarian cancer and the importance of peritoneal spread. From there, I got talked out of the academic position that I wanted and ended up in private practice doing gynecologic oncology initially until I had my first child's adopted from Guatemala. Once I had my daughter, I wasn't getting any time off on the weekends. So I started doing OB-GYN, added that to my practice at that point, just to get call coverage on the weekends. Well, things changed with reimbursement and the GYN oncology part was no longer feasible. So surgeries that I was getting reimbursed several thousand dollars for all of a sudden dropped below $1,000. And when you're doing 8 hours of work, getting $1,000 for it is not enough. Because you still have to pay for your staff and your office and all of that out of that. So I switched gears, got training for cosmetic surgery, did that for roughly 10 years. And the economy was up and down during that time period. We decided it wasn't enough to support our family. So I took an employed position at that time, first doing a temporary position at one of the prisons as a healthcare provider in a women's prison, and then worked at an urgent care. And the interesting thing about the urgent care is I also got trained in opioid use disorder. So I got my waiver DEA so that I could prescribe buprenorphine products. And I had, I think, somewhere around 100 patients that were on buprenorphine by the time I left the urgent care, Well, the reason I left the urgent care is I was functioning also as a hospitalist, and I was working 14 to 16 hour days. At that time, all three of my children were living with me. My daughter was 17. She had a baby. So we also had the granddaughter with us. At that time, I wasn't getting to spend time with any of them. Plus, my youngest was still in high school. So I was missing most of his activities in marching band and concert band and things like that, sporting events. So that's why I started looking for another job. And I had three different interviews with three different companies to provide both pain management and opioid use disorder management. And the Angels Clinic system seemed to be the best fit. So I started working there in September of 2018. So what happened there was a bit of a mess.
Yes, please get into that. Yes, that is the crux of the conversation.
Correct. The ownership interviewed me twice on it. Both times they told me all patients were charged $210 for a visit. That's all. Just one price, all patients. Okay. Sounded legitimate to me. I talked to them about how they prevented drug runners from coming into their practice, or drug dealers from coming into their practice. And they said, oh, don't worry about that. Our staff is very well trained to identify them. They don't let people congregate in the parking lots. They don't let people come in with large groups of people. They know how to identify drug runners, and they will kick them out before they even get checked in or anything. So then I had the opportunity to talk to three different physicians, and they all told me the same thing. Drug dealing is going to be a part of every pain management physician, but it's usually only about 5 to 6%. I'm like, okay, I can deal with that. When I asked how you identify them, they said, we don't know. We don't know how to identify fake patients, because as physicians, we're taught to trust patients. So then I talked to their medical director, a doctor by the name of Jed Graham. Talked to him several times about identifying fake patients, making sure you're not giving medication to fake patients. And he gave me very solid answers on all of it. How to do a focused exam. We talked about that, and how to document things so that whoever is scrutinizing your charts knows that you are practicing legitimate medicine. So I was following all of those rules and everything. Well, the first month or so went fine, but then the medical assistant that was helping me was charging people, I believe it was $50, which she was pocketing to falsify the drug report, like for on a urine drug screen. On it, and they were using urine drug screens that they send out. So they would send them out, and 3 days later, we would get the result. And I'm like, how does that work? You know, because that didn't make sense to me. Like, if somebody's using cocaine or heroin or some other product, I need to know about it before I write a prescription. Not 3 days later. So that was the first discrepancy. Well, that girl got fired, and then they brought two other girls in. They told me that the first girl they brought in had been working for them for 8 years, and that she was one of their best employees. So she starts working for me. Business starts increasing. We capped it at 25 patients a day for the most part. In fact, my average was 18. So a reasonable amount of patients. I left my home late enough in the morning that I was getting there around 9 o'clock. but it gave me time to spend with my son, my youngest son, and my granddaughter. I was home by dinner. Most nights, I didn't work weekends. I mean, I had family time for the first time in 4 years. So I was very happy with that until I guess it was about a week or maybe 2 weeks before I had a scheduled vacation in August. One of the patients needed to be increased on her medicine. She was on Norco. I said, why don't we put you on oxycodone and see if you do better on that? And she said, I can't afford it. And I said, well, I know the medication is more expensive, but you won't need as many pills because you can cut them in half. So she said, no, the appointment's more expensive. And I said, what? So unbeknownst to me, they were charging $450 for oxycodone, $210 for hydrocodone, and $110 for codeine. And I found all of this out during the discovery phase before my trial. Didn't know any of it while I was working there. So I go on vacation. I was in Florida visiting one of my sisters. And I got a phone call that Wednesday from the owner of the clinic and said the clinic was raided. And then I get a phone call from my husband saying our house was raided. So what happened at my house was like 5:20 in the morning, seven or more police cars, all with their lights on in our small gated community. And they bang on the door. Terrified my husband, terrified my three kids. Fortunately, my granddaughter slept through it. And my husband's a good negotiator. So he was able to talk the DEA agents and the FBI agents out of looking any further than our kitchen and not waking up our children and putting them on the ground outside, which is what they wanted to do.
An exercise in humiliation. I know all about that.
Yeah, that's exactly what they were trying to do. So the owner of the clinic gave me the name of, gave me the number of his attorney. I called his attorney. His attorney gave me the name of one of his partners who ended up being my attorney. I wasn't exactly comfortable with that either, but I got the right result. So anyway, that attorney, the attorney that I ended up hiring, told me after a very lengthy conversation not to go to the airport, but to drive back to Texas and plan to turn myself in on Monday morning. And I'm like, why would I turn myself in? I didn't do anything wrong. It didn't make sense to me.
So this is the concept that you and I are very familiar with that very few people understand. These charges, these investigations, they're portrayed as these massive months-long, year-long investigation, but they always have this kind of surprise element. And I'm not sure whether that's conspired or whether that's simply that's how they proceed with things, but it's very difficult for people to understand that they really do just come out of left field with this incredible amount of violence and aggressiveness. And when that happened, how did your professional and personal life change at that moment?
Oh, everything changed. I mean, I'm very fortunate my husband did not leave me at that point. But he was very angry, but he didn't want me to take this job to begin with. He was concerned about an arrest based on what I told him about my employment. But from my perspective,
you alluded to this a few times, and I think it's important to talk about that because it's one of those unspoken elements of treating patients with substance use dependency. You know, you either are willing to or not willing to as a physician. And if you're willing to, you know that there are going to be legal risk because the regulators that oversee all of medicine that have no clinical understanding are going to judge physicians a certain way. So there's an inherent risk to that. You talked about cost per medications as a red flag. You talked about identifying drug dealers as a red flag. You spoke about those things in indirect terms, but for anybody like you and I who have been in the crosshairs of a DEA investigation, you know these are the speculative elements of a practice that they'll then try to create as a factual basis of a crime. Talk about how the DEA, in your experience, took speculation and tried to create fact out of insinuations.
Right. They apparently, one of the patients had complained to the DEA that there was drug running going on in my office. So in response to that, the DEA sent in what they call as a cooperating source who was wired and came in. And this cooperating source doesn't come in saying, look, I don't really have pain. I just want the pills, and I want the pills so I can sell them, or I want the pills because I want to get high. That isn't what happens. They come in and say, I fell really hard on a basketball court 5 years ago. The x-ray was normal, and I have not had an MRI in that, but I've had chronic pain since then. And you look at their prescription monitoring program that's online, and you see that every 3 or 4 months, they get 2 or 3 prescriptions of Norco, and then there's a lapse, and then they get 3 or 4 more. And that's been the pattern for like 2 years. So they're on this program with Norco and Soma. They're telling you it works. They're telling you when they run out that they can't work. He said he was a truck driver. He said he had been employed since the last prescription that he got.
They told the undercover agent in my case said he was a truck driver too.
Yeah. I mean, when you're a self-employed truck driver, you can't verify that. And I'm not trained to verify it anyway.
Man, they're really not that original, are they?
No, they're not. But then he came back in 6 weeks later, said he had run out of the Soma. And I said, well, of course you ran out. It's been 6 weeks. I only gave you enough for a month. And he said, well, I stretched him out. So I didn't run out of them right at the end of, or in the middle of July is when it would have been. And I said, well, when did you run out? And he couldn't give me an answer. And yes, that should have been a red flag, but he's a truck driver. He's on the road. This, from my perspective, he's a truck driver. He's on the road. He's got a family. He's got other responsibilities. Maybe he doesn't remember when he ran out of them.
Yeah.
So is that enough of a reason to withhold medicine from this man? And I didn't think so, especially since he told me he was back at work because of being on the medicine that I gave him.
Yeah. No, I'm completely with you on this. And what's so funny about this is like how they take insinuation that people will then look at and say, how didn't you know? So in my case, he told me, the undercover DEA agent, he told me, I still remember his name, Todd Greenberg, a truck driver from Florida who recently moved to Indiana, did not have time to get his insurance yet, so he was paying cash. Okay, you see that a lot. Truck drivers moving from state to state, it takes a time to get onto Medicaid, so you wait. When I asked him to do the urine drug screen, he said he could not afford it and asked me if I was willing to wait until he got insurance to perform his urine drug screen. I said, I'm willing to wait. Now, I take that only to show you that I have a personal bias to recognize what you're thinking and how you're thinking and look at it in the vein of saying that is clinical compassion. Now, when I tell my story to other physicians, they say, how could you not have known? How could you have not have known that you should have preferred your drug screen. And the very same physicians who tell me that will also readily admit that they trust their patients, that they give concessions to their patients. And what's very interesting about this is that you and I have a common bond of being unjustly targeted by the DEA using deliberately unconstitutional tactics. But the way they go about this is they take insinuation and they take speculation and infuse just enough gray area to make it seem like you should have known. And that is a very pervasive phrase. You should have known. That came up numerous times in my case. You should have known. As if some non-clinically trained prosecutor can tell me, a trained clinical physician, what I should and should have not known. And I ask you, this phrase, and I sense I'm getting a little personal here, and I think that's important because that phrase, you should have known, is very impactful. Tell us what that phrase means to you and how that phrase was weaponized against you.
During the trial, it absolutely was. They showed a picture of the clinic where I was working that has no markings on it. So there's no clinic name, no physician name, nothing on the door. You wouldn't know what it was. The family practice clinic that was right next to it was affiliated with it. So that's how people were directed there. It was Angel's Clinica Familia. And it's the next door down from that is where the practice was. So what they did during the trial is that I should have known this was an illegitimate business because there was no name on the door. And then they showed the front window and that I would come up to the front window to hand off the chart to the nurse or medical assistant that was sitting there before I would go back to the back. Well, the whole front of that was windows. So they said she was, Dr. Marino was coming up several times a day to this window. Of course she could see what was going on in the parking lot. She should have known what was going on in the parking lot. Well, the truth of the matter is, from my perspective where I was, I could see that because it was an L-shaped shopping center, I could see the back part of the L and the cars that were right in front of those few stores, not what was going down in the main parking lot, which is where all the activity was happening. I never saw what was going on there. And they also alluded to the fact that that I was seeing the crew leaders come in every day. No, I didn't. I never saw anybody pay for more than one patient. I never saw large amounts of cash being deposited there. I wasn't in the front when they were taking money. So, and as far as seeing the crew leaders, I maybe 3 or 4 times in the whole year that I worked there, did I ever go to the waiting room to get a patient? We had 3 exam rooms. I went from exam room to exam room to exam room. I didn't go to the waiting room to get patients, but they made it sound like I did. And I should have known because this one guy was 6'6" and 400 pounds. You couldn't miss him. Well, I only remember seeing him once on a day that he wasn't scheduled. And I'm like, okay, maybe he brought a friend. Well, didn't know he was bringing people. So
that's interesting. So ultimately, you were acquitted on certain counts, and there was a non-decision on other counts. So in many ways, for all intents and purposes, you won. And I don't mean to oversimplify because the legal system is never that simple when it comes to physicians being targeted by the DEA, but you prevailed. Talk a little bit about that decision not to plea, because you and I both know I pled. I was pressured. I dare say I was coerced according to the legal definition. I succumbed to the pressure. that was imposed on me. You didn't. And that to me is incredibly powerful. What strength did you find not to coerce to the Department of Justice and the pressure that they put on you? Because I know firsthand just how abusive they can be.
They, I think because I wasn't home when the raid happened, and I never talked to a DEA agent after the arrest. I think that played an important part, and that was just God's protection. I mean, the timing of my vacation with my sister, she gave me incredible support during the time after the arrest, and has for the past 5 years. But my attorney never pressured me to take a plea, and I never spoke to a DEA agent until there was a reverse proffer in September of 23, because the original trial was supposed to be in October. So it was about a month before that scheduled.
Describe a reverse proffer for those who may not be familiar with that term.
A reverse proffer is where the prosecution provides all of the evidence that they have against you in hopes that you will take a plea deal. Well, the fact of the matter is, in the reverse proffer, they didn't provide any evidence that they had against me at all. But they had,
man, it's just funny.
Employees admitting that they had never talked to me about the drug conspiracy. And that happened in the trial too. The drug runners that came in as patients that were arrested and testified on behalf of the prosecution, and the two employees that I thought I could trust, all said the same thing. They all said, I'd never talked to Dr. Marino about this. I never talked to her about the drug running. I didn't.
So, you know, in advance of this interview, and I apologize in advance because I know how traumatizing this is, I Googled you, and I know the pain of being Googled. So when I Google you, I see all the indictments, all the DEA propaganda. I never see anything about the false statements from the witnesses. I never see anything about the acquittals. So when all of this is going on, so you have the reverse proffer, it proves that there's really no factual basis against you. They still take you to trial. You go to trial.
Well, and just to clarify too, the number one charge was conspiracy. So conspiracy to distribute drugs. Charges 2 and 3 were about the cooperating source. So the two visits with him.
Undercover DEA agent.
Of those visits, and they had his medical records. And the jury saw that I believed I was giving legitimate pain medicine to a legitimate patient. So that's why I was acquitted on those two. So, but they had their expert review 40 charts. I did not have 40 charges against me. They never filed any charges on those other 40 charts that the non-opiate prescribing expert said were illegitimate.
So why were you portrayed as much in the media?
because the media believes everything the DOJ says.
you know, what's very interesting about that. And, you know, I apologize because there's just a certain jealousy I have, to be completely frank, that you were brave enough to fight the Department of Justice and prevail. And I was not brave enough to do so. And what's so interesting is that the same number of years that I was under before I was able to resume my practice is the same number of years the DOJ basically put you through the ringer before you were eventually acquitted or jury. And I often hear cases where physicians in my situation are told by their counsel, as I was told, just plead, it'll go away. And you'll go back to practicing. Oh, if you just give them the conviction that they're so desperately seeking, they'll let you go and practice. And you start to hear these kind of quid pro quo arrangements from your defense attorney, as I did. And I'm very curious to see, how did you formulate a relationship with your defense attorney where you didn't have these games from your lawyer? You somehow managed to have an attorney that was honest and straightforward. And I find that unique, as sad as that sounds.
Yeah, he was surprisingly honest in that regard, because what he told me when I was first arrested, that the prosecution has never lost in the Southern District of Texas. He
for physicians in opioid related cases.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that if convicted, I would be looking at anywhere from 20 to 60 years, because there were three charges and each one would be a 20-year sentence. Whether they got to be served consecutively or not would be up to the judge.
The trial tax, as they say.
Right. And he said, if I took a plea, I would likely be looking at 8 years in prison. To which I said, I'm not going to prison.
On a personal front, where did you find the strength to take that position? Did you ever encounter people in your family, social circle that were like, what are you doing? Just give them what they want and move on with your life. Don't fight the government. They'll never let you go, so on and so forth. What was that like?
I actually didn't have that kind of a relationship. I'm the youngest of six kids, and I mean, one of my brothers is not reliable, so he has never been told about what's going on. But the others have all been very, very supportive.
Luckily.
I had one sister who early on said, well, maybe God has a plan for you in prison. And I said, Mary, I'm not going to prison.
Yeah.
So she did show up for the trial. She lives here in Houston, so she did show up for the trial every day, and I did appreciate her support. But my faith has a lot to do with the strength that I have. But if God be for you, who dare come against you? And that's how I approach this whole case, is I know God is for me, so the DOJ better not come against me, because they're going to lose. And they did.
Wow. Wow. I hope physicians can look at your story, just look at how you were portrayed, and just feel the strength that's just emanating from you, and recognize that as a physician, you have an opportunity to stand up for yourself. You have a choice to fight. And in this world where settlements are the norm, pleas are effectively standard of care in the legal system, it's amazing to see your outcome. So what's next for you?
One thing I do want to say too is, during the trial, there were three other physicians that were arrested the same day that I was, but they were not part of the ANGEL system, the system that I was in. The two drug runners said that all they had to do at these other physicians' office was drop off their ID and they would get medication. No exam, no history, nothing. And those physicians all took plea bargains. Now, unfortunately, one of them died within 4 months of being in prison, but the other two took pleas. And if I had been engaged in that type of behavior, I would have taken a plea.
So that's interesting, because
solid medicine.
Right. You know, what happens in the general public, we all tend to get lumped together, right? Any physician that's indicted, that's charged, so on and so forth, it's all under this broad canvas of, well, you must have done something. Well,
right, you were indicted.
You may not have done all of that, but you might have done something, right?
Right.
And how do you maintain credibility in that world where you're almost implicitly guilty just by media speculation?
I've insulated myself by minimizing how many people know about what happened to me. I don't think many of my colleagues that I worked with previously are aware of it. So that's part of the damage control. Yeah. But I've also surrounded me with people that I know will support me.
Well said. So what's next for you? Now that you have your proverbial day in court, emerged victorious, although truth be told, the prosecution still has an option to pursue in some capacity. God willing that they finally make peace with the fact that you are an innocent physician. What's next for you now?
The prosecution is supposed to make their decision by this Friday, May 10th. Mm. So what my attorney has done, because he was negotiating with them to dismiss the conspiracy charge, and they weren't, like, one of them was in favor of it, but her supervisor was not. So he wasn't successful in convincing the supervisor. So what he's going to do is file an ex parte saying he's not going to represent me moving forward, which would allow me time to hire a new attorney and get them caught up to speed if they decide to pursue it. But that puts a retrial a year to 2 years away. Now, that's not an ideal situation for me, but it's even a less ideal situation for them. So we're hoping with a time delay that they'll say it's not worth it. Let's just quit.
It's amazing how procedural motions often dictate what is perceived to be right or wrong in the legal world. So it's not about you being innocent or guilty. It's about taking procedural motions that create a time delay to then determine whether the cost-benefit ratio is justified on the additional expenditure to maintain the trial. People don't understand that. Right.
That is. There was a lot that didn't go right in the trial. First of all, on the conspiracy charge, they had already found that I was not guilty of writing illegitimate prescriptions for illegitimate patients.
So where's the conspiracy?
On the conspiracy charge, 6 of the 12 thought that I was a part of the conspiracy. Well, how can you be a part of the conspiracy if you're not writing illegitimate prescriptions? It didn't make sense.
Where's the conspiracy? Yeah.
Right. Where's the conspiracy? Exactly. So what the judge did was, after the verdict was announced and I left the courtroom with my support team, he invited the jury, 9 of the 12 stayed, to talk to both my attorneys and the prosecution about why there was a hung jury. And what it turned out to be, because my attorney didn't speak up, was everything that they said was under the presumption of guilt, not under the presumption of innocence, which I am supposed to be constitutionally guaranteed.
So they effectively just assumed you were guilty. So whatever insinuation, fact or no fact, whatever insinuation that was thrown up, it simply just corroborated the preconceived notion that they had. And I think you see that a lot in your case, because you see a media barrage of speculative articles, of just outright defamatory articles, but you don't see anything about the hung jury. You see hardly anything about the acquittals. And
right.
I'm curious, did you all reach out to these media outlets that so vigorously wrote these terrible things about you to say, why aren't you writing about the acquittal? Why aren't you writing about the hung jury?
Not yet. Most of that is because I'm waiting to see what their decision is going to be on Friday, which I'm believing is going to be for dismissal of that last charge.
Hmm. I can tell you from...
That would be a good move to make.
I can tell you from my personal experience that many of these media outlets are more focused on maintaining their sources and are willing to play ball when it comes to maintaining those sources than they are to maintain a certain truthfulness or veracity towards evidence-based journalism. And that's just right. In my experience. And I hope that in the end that the media gets things right when it comes to your situation as well.
Yeah, I hope so too, but that's been my experience as well, is if you don't support the narrative that they're trying to promote, they're not going to publish what you have. And that, unfortunately, that's happening in medical journals now too, is it's very difficult to find truth and integrity, even in medical journals, because the agenda pushing has gotten so out of control.
Well, I mean, that's where physicians like you and I have to play a part, and we have to recognize the importance of our mission, because when nobody believed in us, we believe in ourselves. When the whole world wanted to cast us a certain way, we told the truth. And I have all the respect in the world for you for just believing in yourself enough to stand up for yourself. And that's something I can't say about myself. So when I speak to you, I just feel an immense amount of just respect. And I use the word jealousy because in many ways I feel like, how come I didn't have that strength? How come I didn't have that self-confidence that you had? And it's just amazing that you're able to, against everything that was mounted against you, be able to stand strong and hold your head high.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't know. I'm overwhelmed with the jury's acquittal, for sure. And know that I couldn't have done it without God, but it is huge. It is, I mean, it's not an accomplishment of me, but it's an accomplishment of what can be done even against a very corrupt government.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing that I've learned over these past 5 years. And I know you've talked to Dr. Anand about this too. These attacks on us are very targeted.
Yeah.
They're targeted based on assets. They're targeted based on practice setting. Solo practice and small group practices are exclusively attacked, not people in employed positions or in academic institutions. And it's primarily Black or Brown physicians, foreign medical grads, people over the age of 50. And it's got to change. One of the biggest thing that needs to change is the regulation of the DEA registration needs to be taken away from the DEA. So, and people have been saying that for decades. So it needs to happen.
Dr. Marino, in the time that we have in this just, immensely personal conversation that I've had, and I apologize if I injected so much of my own personal experiences into this, but I feel, as you know, a certain level of kindred spirit and just what you've gone through, and just a certain level of relatability that I don't think that I can ever speak to you in an objective manner, knowing how similar our situations were and just how immensely proud I am of the way you've handled it relative to the way I handled it.
Thank you.
Yeah, in the remaining time that we have, what words of advice or wisdom would you give to physicians who may be similarly targeted by the DEA, DOJ, or other overzealous regulatory bodies that seem to be seeking personal or professional gain out of, in many ways, weaponizing the practice of medicine? What advice would you have for those physicians who may be similarly targeted?
I think the most important thing right now is, if you are capable of retiring or getting into a completely different line of work, do it. Stop the practice of medicine, because not enough of our colleagues have stood up to the tyranny of our government. And that's what the problem is. The fact that there are hospitals where they do surgery, they have operating rooms, and they are opioid free just nauseates me. I mean, I would stop being a surgeon under those circumstances, but too many of our colleagues haven't. They haven't said, no, you're not going to tell us not to prescribe opiates to post-op patients. And the damage to the chronic pain community has been devastating. Absolutely devastating. I mean, it's torture to live with uncontrolled pain. And that's what our government is doing to people who have chronic painful conditions.
All for the name of a narrative that seems to have no basis. It's a shame.
Absolutely no basis. Right.
Yeah. With that, Dr. Marino, thank you so much for your time, and look forward to carrying the conversation.
All right. Thank you.